Okay. I'm glad I'm taking the line from your paper because you transferred us into from general discussions to more individual lives and how they can intersect with the social. And this is what I'm taking on in this paper, where I talk about the life and art of Mae Stevens, an American working class artist born in 1924 in Massachusetts. She studied at the Mass Art School in Boston, which is the first public funded art school in the history of the United States and remains the only one today. But she also spent three years in the Académie Jidan in Paris, where she lived with her husband for 3 years between 1948 and 1951. On returning to New York, Mae Stevens became actively involved in the social movements of the turbulent 60s, fighting against racism, imperialism, war, and sexism. It was through these movements that she became of age as an artist, and thus her art and politics have been inextricably interwoven. Her work, I argue, creates a kind of a Mobius strip with her politics. You're never sure which is the inside or outside. However, if we were to create a series of events of what I will call a Stevens art politics, her early involvement in the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War protest marks her work. The dominant figure of this series is her patriotic working class father, depicted as both powerful, draped in the American flag, or impersonated as the Holy Trinidad, but also impotent. He is, after all, a paper doll. We have in this early work the emergence of a motif of couplets, dualisms, and antitheses that will become recurrent in her work, particularly so with the Ordinary Extraordinary series that I will discuss later on. But before doing that, there are two other dimensions in the Big Daddy series work that I want to know. First, the mingling of the personal and the political. It is her daddy, after all, whose caricature she draws as a patriarchal symbol of nationalism, religiosity, patriotism, oppression, and violence. And second, an early intersectional approach that went through her artwork and brings me to the second phase of her work. In the 70s, Stevens became actively involved in several women's groups, and these activities ended up in two important interventions: the establishment of an art school, the Feminist Art Institute, and the publication of the journal Heresies, a feminist publication on art and politics. Her active involvement in the women's movement notwithstanding, Stevens was from the beginning skeptical of its essential strengths. And she talks about it with in a series of conversations that have been published as a book with Patricia Hills. She says, for example, Shapiro had been out in California working with Judy Sicago, and the two of them were developing a theory that women's work, if it's truly women's work, had round or oval forms in it, which had been suppressed in the male art world. But I'm thinking, I don't like round forms necessarily. I was curious, and I thought, I don't want these women putting me in a bind, telling me what to do. Men were telling us what to do. Are women also going to tell us what to do? So in adopting an intersectional, area intersectional approach, the term hadn't even been coined, Stevens would highlight the fact that social class and race were part and parcel of women's oppression, in ways that were often subtle and indiscernible within the women's movement. In this light, in 1992, she invited the black artist Vivian Brown to join Heresies, and together they edited a special issue on race called Racism is the Issue. Stevens' feminist politics are most starkly expressed in her series of counter-historical paintings as her famous Soho women artists. We have here a collection of bodies parallel to what Les was talking about. Mystery and politics, and Artemisia. This was a project of reimagining women as historical subjects through an intervention in the high genre of historical paintings, which was initiated by the artist studio after Courbet. In following trails of Stevens' art politics, we have thus reached the 80s, which is the decade marked by her interest in Rosa Luxemburg, as depicted in the Ordinary Extraordinary series that I will now discuss. And I quote here from the artist's book, which was the first in the series. Ordinary, extraordinary. A collage of words and images of Rosa Luxemburg, Polish German revolutionary leader and theoretician, murder victim, juxtaposed with images and words of Alice Stevens, housewife, mother, washer and ironer, inmate of hospitals and nursing homes. A filmic sequence of darks and lights, moving through close-up to long view and back, oblique, direct. Fragments of Rosa's thought from intimate notes sent from prison to her comrade and lover Leon Gihes and to her friends. From agitprop published in Der Rote Fachner and from her serious scientific writings. Images from her girlhood, her middle life, and the final photograph of her murdered head. Alice's words from the memory of and letters to her daughter, an artist's book examining and documenting the mark of a political woman whose life would otherwise be unmarked, ordinary, extraordinary. End of quote. I was quite moved when I read this powerful blurb from May Stevens' artist book, which appeared in 1980 in the process of the artist's long preoccupation with Rosa Luxemburg, and lasted for over 10 years and again returned as a theme to her work in 2001. Ordinary, extraordinary is a poetic way of bringing two very different women together, the artist's mother and the celebrated political theorist and activist. However, as Stevens has remarked in her conversation with Patricia Hills, ordinary, extraordinary should not be taken as a dualistic opposition between the two women, configuring her mother Alice as ordinary and Rosa as extraordinary. And I quote here from her conversations with Hills. It was important to me that people realize that both words, ordinary and extraordinary, refer to both women. I wanted to make Alice Stevens understood as a woman of a certain character, who was quite unique and impressive in her own way. Rosa Luxemburg, the brilliant theoretician, was also a very ordinary human being. I worked with those ideas, end of quote. Both women were for Stevens simultaneously ordinary and extraordinary then, a thought whose philosophical life can be traced back, I argue, to Hannah Arendt's argument about the uniqueness of the human condition, the importance of who one is as juxtaposed to the inevitable and politically dangerous reduction of what one is, that has historically fueled totalitarian classifications and in turn resulted in gross human rights violations. In these slides, narratives are particularly instrumental in revealing the who and what the ordinary extraordinary series creates is an assemblage of visual and textual narratives, revealing the unrepeatable uniqueness of human beings. Epistolary narratives and the force of human communication through writing thus become important compositional elements of the ordinary extraordinary series. Having read many articles from exhibition catalogues of this series, I was intrigued by the way the use of letters in the text of the collage and the artist book was of course mentioned, but never really commented, analyzed, or discussed. Although feminist art critics have not analyzed the use of letters, in her recorded conversations with Hill, Stevens has referred extensively to how she was drawn to Rosa Luxemburg by reading her correspondence to her lover. Luxemburg's letters have thus triggered the very ambiguity of the ordinary-extraordinary distinction that Stevens was playing with in the artist book and the subsequent art series. Rosa Luxemburg and Alice Stevens as both ordinary and extraordinary women, exposing themselves through their epistolary fragments as unique and unrepeatable, but also vulnerable, relational, and dependent on significant others. Although written to the moment, as all letters are, in crystallizing the moment and spirit of its creation, the letter intervenes in our perception of linear time and finite life, and shows that the force of human life, if rendered into a story, transcends the limitations of the lifespan and enters the discourse of history, which ultimately becomes, and I quote here from Arendt, the storybook of mankind with many actors and speakers and yet without any tangible author. End of quote. Not only do individual human lives enter the discourse of history, Arendt argues, but actually their life stories are creating conditions of possibility for history itself. And it's Hannah Arendt again, that every individual life between birth and death can eventually be told as a story with beginnings and end, is the pre-political and pre-historical condition of history, the great story without beginning and end. End of quote. Stevens was particularly preoccupied with the idea of the unfinished story, something that you took in your paper as a catastrophe and a new beginning, forcefully and dramatically encapsulated in the famous ending line from Luxemburg's last known piece of writing, Order Prevails in Berlin. I was, I am, I shall be, has become for Stevens the phrase that dominates voices. Her painting of Luxembourg's funeral, thus transforming her death from an end to an event, creating possibilities for new beginnings. Stevens' portrayal of Luxembourg's murder as an unfinished story foregrounds three interrelated themes in her approach to life and art: the incessant cycle of life and death, the importance of history painting, and the salience of new beginnings that is also fundamental in Arendt's philosophy. So Stevens, in her conversations again with Patricia Hills, has argued that one thing that has very much interested in her work is examining women's lives of different times and see how different women cross different times. So in doing this crossing time project, Stevens creates, I argue, visual biographies. And in presenting different women of different times, it is not just significant events that her artwork capturates and recasts, but also things that for us would stay non-events, like her mother postcards, and more importantly, her mother's silences. So, just to conclude, we talked a lot about Rancière and the distribution of the sensible, so I'm very happy about it because I wouldn't have any time to say anything. But what I will try to argue here in my five conclusions is that this notion of le partage du sensible, or distribution of the sensible, however you want to translate it, has very specific limitations, and it's very it's too much structuralist if you want to take it. So what I'm trying to do in my conclusion is that to use May Stevens' case as an argument about disrupting the distribution of the sensible, not just in subject matter, but also as a concept, and arguing that actually we use a much more fluent a rhythmic idea and concept than what Rancière can actually offer. But having said that, I still find it a useful framework to summarize the five aesthetic interventions that I have argued May Stevens has done. And I will summarize them very quickly: creating assemblages of visual images, stories, and words, using epistolary texts as signs that surprise and woo the viewer in the tradition of the Bartian pantum, working on the interface of paintings and photographs, the imagined and the real, creating visual biographies of parallel lives, and visualizing temporality in the form of series of repetitions and small differences. Because I will agree with your comment earlier on that painting is on the surface. So if you work on the surface, how can you give this idea of temporality? And I argue she does this with this idea of repetitions and differences. And I think these are some practices in my argument to some discussions that came earlier today. How can we actually have an idea of what can we do with this sensible? My argument is that we actually have to look very closely into artistic practices and analyze them in context. We can't have an overall argument about what we can do with that, but we should, do it all the time in context. And thanks.
Thank you.